Night in the acoustic music series in Pasadena, which includes both of you, all three of you, and Peter Case as well. And I mentioned before we played Peter's cutoff to Larry Dust that I just sort of thought that the idea had been Rollins, who puts the concert series together. But he says the idea was really yours to do this concert on Saturday night.
Well, I was coming out anyway. I'm going to start a record with Dave and Greg Lee's producing, because I was such a fan of King of California. And we worked well together on Tulare Dust. The sounds were kind of went together. So Dave and I are going to be, and Andy and Greg are going to be recording over the next couple weeks. So I thought it'd be nice to, if possible, do a gig or two while we're out here with Dave and Peter, and Ron was able to fix up the date in Pasadena. So it worked out.
Do you have any other gigs that you're going to have a chance to do, like maybe farther down towards San Diego? Or
no, unfortunately, we're doing, the rest of them are all up in Northern California, like San Francisco and San Luis Obispo. No, Santa Cruz and Davis.
You have the dates off the top of your head?
Yeah, I think Davis is the 12th. San Francisco is at the Noe Valley Ministry.
13th.
On the 13th. Davis is a great club called
The Palms.
Which is a great acoustic room, and Noe Valley Ministry is supposed to be a great acoustic room, and then the third one is the Coomba Jazz Center in Santa Cruz, which is also a great acoustic room. So
that's
the acoustic
on the 14th.
Room tour.
Yeah, the acoustic tour. Yeah.
So if you're headed up in a couple of weeks to the Bay Area, follow these guys.
A show might evolve.
That's right. If you come up, if you can find us and tell us you heard us on this show, we'll get you in free to the Northern California date.
Dave Alvin said
to
that.
To the Northern California date. Yeah, but you know how hard it is to find me.
That's true. We were looking for you about 20 minutes ago.
Both of you tell us about your first experiences with the music of Merle Haggard. You want to start, Tom?
Well, I grew up, I was born in L.A. and grew up here, lived here about 20 years, and my brother was really into country music in the 50s. He turned out to be a cowboy, and he lives up near San Luis Obispo now, but he had, I remember Hank Williams 78s that my brother brought home, and then he started getting turned on to people like the Maddox Brothers and Rosen and the Bakersfield scene, so... Early on, he had some Merle records in the 60s once Merle started recording, mid-60s. And I was kind of reluctant at first because I was listening back then to more folk music and Ian and Sylvia and Dylan. I was interested in songwriters. But suddenly it hit me how good Haggard's songs were back in the mid and late 60s. So I kind of started swiping my brother's records and, trying to go to see Merle whenever I could.
Uh-huh. And you held the passion up till now.
Well, yeah, then flash forward about 20 years or 30 years, wherever we are now, and Dave Alvin comes to New York, must have been 3 or 4 years ago, and
with Merle, yeah.
Did a show with Merle at the Ritz, actually a rock and roll club, and Dave was kind enough to let Andy and I sit in with him, and we got to meet Merle, and... Merle did a fantastic show, so I think maybe the spark of the inspiration was there, thanks to Dave.
It was really, the funny thing about that show is I felt kind of far away from home that day in New York for whatever reasons, and when Greg and I walked in to do the sound check, Merle's two crew guys were like, Merle's band had just finished sound checking, his two crew guys were like, hey, there's a guy from California, come on up, what do you need, we'll take care of you. I was like, hey, I'm home. And but unfortunately, when I met Merle that night, he was wonderful, but it was one of those situations where, what do you say? You know, you meet Mark Twain, what do you say to Mark Twain? You meet Bob Dylan, what do you say to Bob Dylan? You meet Merle Haggard, what do you say? And I was like, nice to meet you, Miss Haggard. And he's like, nice to meet you, you sounded real good. Oh, thanks, bye. You know, one of those situations. And, you know, of course, an hour later, you're realizing everything you could have ever said to him. So... But my thing with Merle was similar to Tom's. I grew up, I had like one cousin that was into R&B, and I had another cousin that was into, Phil Oakes and Bob Dylan and Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. And then I had this other cousin, JJ, and JJ was a cowboy, and he would come over to the family gatherings, and everybody would like pull out a guitar or a banjo or something, and JJ would pull out a red electric Gibson guitar with a little portable red amp, and he had these great, he had those kind of cowboy boots that didn't come up high, they were like just ankle high, and he'd sit down, and I remember his straight leg pants coming up over, and I could see his ankles through the boots, and through the top of the boots, and he would say, "Now, all right, I'm going to do a Stonewall Jackson song," and my folk singing cousin would be like, "Oh, man," and then my cousin JJ would be like, "Well, you guys are so square, you're so square, you don't know anything." So that was really where I first heard, like, the names of, like, George Jones, Merle Haggard, and I was, you know, 7 or 8. But later on, you know, there used to be these great TV shows out here. Cal Worthington would have, like, the Buck Owens show, you know, and the Collins kids and all that stuff. So that's, you know.
Cal Worthington, all roads lead to Worthington. All freeways lead to Worthington. No, it's got to look good for you. Listen,
wait a minute. Transistor radio, just my
own thing. Dave Warburg coming there.
We call it underwriting in public radio. We might be able to sneak in.
Cliffy Stone.
As long as he still cuts us a check. It's, you know,
right. You, I mentioned that when I met Merle. He was kind of, he has that really a 1,000-yard stare to him, you know, if he doesn't know you, you know. And but when I mentioned California in the early days and the Collins kids, his eyes lit up and he started telling me blue stories about Laurie Collins and Johnny Cash in the dressing room, and just then the road manager came up and pulled him away from me and said, "Merle, it's time to go on stage."
It's interesting what you say, Dave, about what do you say when you meet Mark Twain, because I consider Haggard as one of the more important writers and a poet, and I think when Tom was here before, you know, we've talked about that line, the fine line between songs and poetry, and I actually remember back in the 80s at a record store that I owned, you doing some poetry readings. It used to be something that you did with not a lot of regularity, out of bebop. Do you still do stuff like that? Do you still write for, let's say, a different arena or for a different outlet than songs?
Not really. I do some, because sometimes you get an idea in your head to write something down, and you do it, thinking, okay, I'm going to write, you know, this would be a good song. But sometimes I just stop myself if it doesn't sound like it could be a song, if it's going to be a poem. Where years ago I got more into writing, because I studied poetry before I started writing songs, and I learned how to write it, sort of, you know. But these days, you know, it's like when I sit down to write, because I earn my living writing, I almost want to see a result, you know what I mean? And a poem is a different state of mind. It's you know, it's not for the result. It's not something that you, you know, can take to your record company and say, "Hey, I wrote this great poem," you know? And you can't do that, you know, not unless Harvey Kubernick's running the show. And so I do it a little, and I'm getting ready to do a hopefully have this another book of poetry out this year. But, you know, there's some things that are great, you know, it's really hard to define what makes, let's say, a song lyric poetry and what makes it just a song lyric, you know. And a lot of it is in delivery of the singer, and a lot of it is, you know, in the way you can manage to convey depth, you know, in just a song lyric. So it's hard to say, you know, when people would take Bob Dylan and say, "Well, he's a poet," and all this. But with Merle, I think it's true, because even his bad songs, you know, have this very conversational, direct approach, where he kind of eliminates the barrier between him and the listener. You know what I mean? Where a lot of songs, you just hear them and they go, "Okay, yeah, whatever." But Merle Haggard, he sounds like he's actually talking to you, and he talks in a very, you know, everyday kind of approach. I'm not making any sense here, am I?
We're with you, Dave.
I had heard that either you or your brother Phil was on faculty at
my brother Phil.
Was that at Cal State Long Beach?
Cal State Long Beach, yeah. And as that last diatribe of mine showed, I'm definitely not a college professor. yeah, my brother Phil was.
It was in English or in literature?
No, he taught math.
He taught math. Yeah. And I heard part of the story wrong.
Yeah, well, you know, those rumors are good.
And were you from, did you grow up in that part of Southern California?
I'm from down in California, yeah. I'm like a, my mother's family's from Reedley up by Fresno. And, I'm half Polish and half fourth or fifth generation Californian. And so someone like Merle was real good when I was growing up at giving me an identity of like being from someplace. Where a lot of people who come from California or visit here or move here don't see an identity. And people like Merle Haggard or even Frank Zappa or Johnny Guitar Watson, you know, just very diverse musical things going on in the state of California at a very early age gave me an identity of it, that there is sort of a folk, I won't say culture, but there's folk roots here in this state. Mm-hmm. You know, everything from Don Rich to Dick Dale, you know, there's not that much difference between the two.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting comparison, especially when you think about guitar techniques.
Yeah.
And some of the country guitar players and then how close it was to some of the surf guitar sounds.
Well, you know, they were all out here, you know, the guitar makers were all out here, Bigsby, Fender, all that stuff. The guitar players were all based out here, Merle Travis, you know, Joe Mathis, all those guys were based out here in California in the late 40s, early 50s. And, yeah, I mean, I remember there used to be a great country bar, pardon us for digressing, folks, there used to be a great country bar down in Northeast Long Beach, Northwest Long Beach, called George's Roundup. And it used to have a solid gold Harley Davidson in the front window and a solid gold, or plated, I should say, saddle, you know. And I can't remember the guy's name, but we used to go down there when we were the Blasters and we'd go down on audition nights and there'd be like 40 people in the audience, 40 drunks. And I can't remember the guy who led the band was this old man, and he'd always say to us, "Don't leave before I do Miser Lou." Because the whole night he'd be doing, you know.
Yeah.
But then he'd get wild and do it. You know, so they're pretty close guys. Who's that guy in San Francisco? Jimmy Rivers, you know, the guitar guy? Anyway, I'm digressing.
Cool.
Yeah. Dave Alvin is with us on City Billy tonight, as is Tom Russell and Andrew Harden, and Guitars and Laps. So someone want to take a song and
Tom?
Go.
Okay. But try this new song I wrote with Peter Case. Maybe we'll do it Saturday, but it's called What Do You Want From Me? Dave can play a lead on it. May record this with Dave this week. Well, this old Martin guitar was made in 1946. It's cracked, scratched, and splintered from fingernails and picks. But it's been my close companion since 1952. Please don't ask me to decide between this guitar and you. What do you want from me? What do you want? Do I have to give you everything? What do you want from me? What do you want? Do I have to give you everything? Well, all my friends quit drinking. You can't smoke on planes no more. I think I'll take up smoking, though I've never smoked before. I'm getting tired of decaf coffee. I want some high test in my cup. Too young to die of boredom, and I'm too old to grow up. What do you want from me? What do you want? Do I have to give you everything? What do you want from me? What do you want? Do I have to give you everything? Boxcars, I sold Bibles door to door. Hell, I'd be rich and famous if I weren't unknown and poor. But But blessed are the poor in spirit, for they'll possess the earth. And the day I hand the world to you, you'll ask me what it's worth. What do you want from me? What do you want? Do I have to give you everything? What do you want from me? What do you want? Do I have to give you everything? Do I have to give you everything?
Tom Russell and Andy Harden live on City Billy at FM 89.3 KPCC, Pasadena, Los Angeles, Orange County. I'm Renee Engel on the first show of this year at the halfway point of the program. Also with us in studio, Dave Alvin, and Tom wrote that with Peter Case. So maybe you get to hear it Saturday night.
Yeah.
Disappointed if you didn't get to hear it Saturday night.
Be able to do it. Yeah, do it with Peter.
Have you and Dave written songs together?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot?
We did one called Halley's Comet.
Yeah, it was on the...
Uh-huh.
It was on My Blue Boulevard record and your...
Hurricane Season.
And we had a song called Between the Cracks that was on an album I called Museum of Heart, and it's... We're going to be recording it for Tom's next record.
Yeah, a song that takes place in the San Joaquin Valley, which is a few of the songs we're working on for this record take place there. I wrote a new one with Ian Tyson called The Rose of the San Joaquin, so that theme vaguely runs through three or four of the songs, bringing it all back home.
Could you do that song right now?
Between the Cracks?
Yeah.
Look, what key do you all do it in?
C.
Oh, really? So do I.
Oh, we could do it.
How fortuitous.
You do it fast or slow?
We love your version, man. I don't know, I do it kind of like... But
that's
do it
similar
your
to mine.
Yeah. For the first time.
Oh, by the way,
anymore.
that wasn't me doing any of that lead guitar. That was all the handsome
Andrew
Harden on that song. And guess what? Andrew's going to play lead guitar on this one, too.
Just married.
Sundown on the San Joaquin, an old woman comes home from work, from another day in the fields, another day in the dirt. She lights a sacred candle next to an old photograph, and she says a prayer for a man fell between the cracks. Stares at the photo. Oh, hell, man, you take
she
it.
She stares at the photo of the young man who caused so much pain. In countless 12-round bloodbaths, when Kid Jesus was his name. Was the pride of the valley until the night he stepped down on his back. Yeah, he took a dive and he disappeared somewhere between the cracks. She says Jesus was born a poor boy on the wrong side of the track. But not before he fell between the cracks. She rereads the one letter that he wrote her from L.A. And he said, please don't worry about me, 'cause I'm coming back again someday. But she hears the other stories whispered behind her back about a shooting at a grocery store somewhere between the cracks. She says Jesus was born a poor boy on the wrong side of the
San Joaquin, and an old woman walks off to work. To another day in the fields, and another day in the dirt. And she looks around at the children dropping rich men's fruit in the sand. And she says a prayer for all of us trapped between the cracks. She says Jesus was born a poor boy on the wrong side of the track. And he rose again, but not before. Throw us for a loop there.
You guys dove right in. That's well, nice to do.
Well, I realized when we got to the solo, like on my record, the solo goes one way, and on the tape of your guys, it goes another way, and it was kind of like, how do we avoid the oncoming train wreck that's going to happen here? Yeah, we're going to work that one out.
Dave Alvin, Tom Russell, Andy Harden in studio with us on City Billy tonight on the 2nd of January. You're tuned to FM 89.3 KPCC. God, it's a new year.
Yeah.
I sort of can't believe it. But here we are.
Still alive.
Dave, would you got another song you would do? Just
sure. What do you want? What song you want to hear?
Anything. One of yours.
One of mine? Oh, man. Make it hard on me. Let's see. Well.
Got something new you're working on?
I usually don't pull out new songs because... you know what? I think I'm a pretty
Tom
good.
Russell rips
it off. I think I'm a pretty good songwriter, but you know what? I have no self confidence when it comes to songs, and it takes about 8 phone calls to people late at night, me calling up people. Oh, I got this thing. Can I play it for you over the phone? And
I remember him playing Andersonville for me over the long distance, 3,000 miles. I thought, wow, that's a great song.
I got a song about a dead guy. You got time to hear it? Let's see. Let's do.
Do you find sometimes that even a year or so, a good while after you think it's finished, you might change a word
to change
the meaning of something?
Yeah, always. I mean, one thing is when you're touring a lot. Like I've been on the road for about a year and a half now. And I've just got home about a month ago, and when you're doing that all the time, you're always rewriting and you're finding new things about the songs that you never knew were there before, and you know, like on King California, I recut, you know, several songs that I'd cut either at the Blasters or with X or on my first solo record, and one of the reasons I recut them was, you know, in a couple cases I changed lyrics, in a couple cases I finally figured out what the song was about. Because, you know, a lot of time, you know, if writing a song is purely emotional, you know, and you just want it to rhyme and you capture a mood, you capture a feeling, right? And you don't know really what it means, you know. And even if it's not that deep of a song, it still has a meaning. And when you play it every night, you don't want to get sick of it, you know. So you always play with it, you know, and you always want to keep it as fresh as when you first sat down and wrote it. So, yeah, I change words. I think I changed a few words when we just did Between the Cracks there. You know, just sometimes when you're writing, it comes out less conversational than after you've sung it for a year, you know? And I'll tell you what, let's do one. Can you guys fake King California? Well, I left my home and my one true love east of the Ohio River. Her father said we'd never wed, for I hadn't neither gold nor silver, But my darling dear, please shed no tears. For I think that it's fair to warn you that I'll return to claim you as the king of California. Over deserts hot and mountains cold, I traveled the Indian country, whispering your name under lonesome skies. And your memory, my only company. Now, my darling dear, please have no fear. Oh, I think that it's fair to warn you that I'll return to claim you as the king of California. I went up from Sacramento town to the Sierra Goldfield, and I worked my stake on a river bank, dreaming just how a rich man feels. Now, my darling dear, listen here, for I think that it's fair to warn you that I'll return to claim you as the king of California. A dead man's lying at my feet, and he tried to steal my earnings. Yet I still recall your tender kiss, though his bullet in my chest is burning. Oh, my darling dear, please shed no tears. For I think that it's fair to warn you that I'll return to claim you as the king of California. Yes, I'll return to claim your hand as the king of California.
Damn, it's early in the morning to be doing claw hammers.
Dave Alvin on City Billy. It's good to have you with us. Good to have Dave with us finally. Tom and Andy, it's good to have you guys back right off the plane. So thank you for coming down from the airport. Let's listen to Dave's version of Kern River off To Larry Dust. Come back and talk a little bit more about the making of the album, about the show this Saturday night at the Neighborhood Church in Pasadena. That's Dave Alvin's contribution as far as the song that he sang on To Larry Dust. Songwriter's tribute to Merle Haggard on High Tone Records. Been out just a couple of months. Everything you read calls it one of the more important releases of the year, and I think that that's justified. Dave and Tom Russell both executive produced and produced a good number of the songs on the album. Executive producing usually means that you have a hand in conceiving, then in the execution as to who's going to be invited to do songs for the album, and I guess some input into the songs that you match up with singers. Is that hold on all counts?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
including arguments on over who goes on and who doesn't go on the record. Yeah. First argument, first and hopefully last argument Tom and I ever had was over that. But we won't go into who was who. But,
yeah, we can't say who.
But neither one of them, made it on the record. So,
When word got out that the record was being made, do you start to get inundated with people asking for the opportunity to be on it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that must be tough.
Well, at first, you know, when you think of these things, most people are like, yeah, well, sure, who's doing it, you know? And then after you get a couple of people, then it starts getting, oh, yeah, they're doing it? Well, yeah, I want to do it, you know?
Uh-huh.
But it was pretty easy because, it, like Iris DeMent, didn't she, like, walk up to you and just...
It was like a lot of the stuff was really strange. Like, with Iris, we were halfway through the record, and I picked up a magazine that... Somebody was interviewing her in England or something, asked her what her favorite song was, and she said Big City by Merle Haggard. And I, up to that point, we hadn't thought of Iris, so I called her, and she returned the call like 10 minutes later and said, I'd love to do it, and the track was done within 4 days or something. So a lot of things went like that. Robert Earl Keane, same thing.
Yeah, Dwight was, I ran into Dwight at a Western clothing place, and, you know, just... Hey, Dwight, you want to, Tom Russell and I are producing this Merle Haggard tribute. You want to be on it? He's like, yeah. Who else is on it? And I was like, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, Iris DeMent. Man, if Iris DeMent's on there, I want to be on it, you know. So it was real easy. Yeah. In that, you know, but then.
Lucinda was the, came in right underneath the wire, right before the mastering of the album. Her track came in the mail, that's vintage Lucinda.
But the thing we kind of wanted to push was, I don't know, I guess Tom and I both have different reasons for doing this, but, you know, some people try to, Merle's a real complicated, ambiguous, complex guy, you know, and I think that too, you know, you talk about Okie from Muskogee and all that kind of stuff, you get one dimension, but then on songs like Irma Jackson and Tearing the Labor Camps Down, you get this whole other dimension that both are contradictory. You know, and I think that's one of the reasons why he is a great artist. He's a walking contradiction, you know. He's a country artist that's a traditional dyed-in-the-wool country artist that's incredibly experimental. You know,
we try to get into that a little in the liner notes because a lot of younger people, if you mention Haggard, and if they're not familiar with his catalog, they'll immediately jump on something like Okie from Muskogee or Fight Inside of Me, and they'll say, "Oh, a right winger."
Yeah,
and as we point out in the liner notes, that's a bit away from the reality of the guy's catalog. I mean, an aberration in a way, but it's just another side of Merle, you know.
The experimental thing that you talk about is something that's very borne out in his live shows. Because I've seen him, I didn't get to see back in the 60s, but through 70s, and 80s and 90s, I've tried to get to every Haggard show that I could get to. All been here in Los Angeles. And no two shows are alike. Some can be really inspired, actually. Sometimes he has that reputation for being so enigmatic that he won't be into it. It's tough even getting him to do the show. And sometimes he comes out and he'll construct things that are so experimental where he will... we were all at this show a few years back, which was the triple bill that we were all dying to see at Universal Amphitheater with Haggard and George Jones and Conway Twitty.
Oh, yeah,
like my three favorite guys, you know? And Haggard actually opened by sort of interpolating like part of a song as a recitative, as you would, you know, like almost in an opera aria, before he went into the song proper that he was going to do, which was a completely different song. And I mean, you just wouldn't expect a popular music writer and performer to think of doing things like that in a show.
Yeah, well, he's a lot like, I mean, this is going to sound a little wacky or cliche maybe, but he's a lot like Bob Dylan. And one of the things that I admire about Merle is if, you know, roughly their time in the music business has been about the same, and both have continually written great songs. You know, they've written some bad songs too, but overall they have continued to evolve and to change and to progress and bring new depth to their new work and to their old work and all that. And there's not a lot of people out there that can do that over a course of a career. You know, And you know, anyway, I've talked enough, but no. There's very few, in country music and R&B or in rock and roll or anything that have gone 30 some years and continued to be this enigma, you know, and Merle Haggard's just like Dylan in that respect.
What struck me though, and after I saw that show he did with Dave at the Ritz, was 3 years later he came back to New York and I took my girlfriend to see him. I said, you got to see Haggard while he's alive because she's a Lefty Frizzell fan. This time he was playing in a more low-down bar called Tramps with a bad sound system to 100 people, and loud. People were yelling, "Request Disrespectful." And I thought, here is the top songwriter, I think, of the last 30 years in country music at least. And he's playing in a bar to 100 people while other people are playing in stadiums. And he hasn't gotten any major country airplay in 10 or 12 years, you know. And yet... that just segues with what Dave says, and yet here's a guy like Dylan who is still creatively alive, you know, and he's playing in a bar, you know, and it made me think, too, of Lefty Frizzell. I mean, what happened to Lefty Frizzell after 1955? He died in 1974.
Uh-huh.
But what was he doing those 15 years? Nobody cared about him, and it didn't seem to me that until this year, and I'm not saying just us, it didn't seem to me anybody much cared about Merle Haggard. Up until this year, all these good things have happened for him, which he deserves. But it was to me, it's kind of sad that a guy's written 500 great songs, you know, heretofore hasn't been recognized for it.
Have you sent a copy of this up to him, Shasta?
Yeah.
And no correspondence back yet?
Oh, well, we haven't heard from Merle directly, but we hear from Merle's people. And like Bob Dylan, he is surrounded by his people.
His people.
It's all been positive, though. You know, actually, do you want to tell the Nashville story?
Well, there's a couple of them that are funny, but
yeah, I know. But
because you know, the other funny thing that obvious about this whole thing was that there's another tribute on Arista, the more the Nashville one, and not to put it down, although you know they've been reviewing them in the same space, a lot of magazines, but and Bruce Fountain that produced that one, it was very nice to us, but. There's been a couple of funny things surrounding that, including Merle, I guess, finally heard both records, and they were at a press conference. And the major push from the media when that one came out was to get Merle involved with the Arista one because there was a film and a special and all this. And at the press conference, they had all the lights and cameras on him, and they asked him what was his favorite cut on that album, and he said he really was partial to the Iris DeMette cut. And Bruce Fountain, the producer of the record, was sitting right next to him, and evidently he turned beet red. I thought, man, that guy will never call me again.
There's Merle sticking up for the California guys. Yeah.
Is there only one song duplication between the two albums?
Yeah.
That
wasn't meant to be, because... Yeah. Boughton sent me the track list. He was very cooperative. He said, your thing's different than ours, as long as it doesn't come out at the same time. And theirs was supposed to come out in August, so I said, no, ours is coming out in November. And the mistake was theirs came out later, so naturally they got compared, and ours kind of won out in the critical polls. But Silver Wings wasn't on the track list. Pam Tillis was supposed to do another song, I forget what it was, it might have been Farmer's Daughter or something like that somebody else did, but they did Silver Wings at the last minute, so we really didn't want to duplicate. The one song we really would have fit this record was Mama's Hungry Eyes, but all the rest of them were kind of, as Boughton said, those were the stars doing the hits.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then,
I mean, we really wanted to get kind of, you know, to show Merle, my idea was to just, in a way, get it to where Merle Haggard had nothing to do with the record, if you know what I mean. Where whatever preconceived notion you had about Merle Haggard was dropped. Because, you know, a lot of the material was the lesser-known stuff, Shopping for Dresses and Irma Jackson, things like that. And the way that the songs were approached, nobody, you know, Robert O'Keefe kind of was in the Daddy Frank vein a little. But everybody else kind of went at their songs, you know, very individually, and nobody was really trying to copy Merle. So what I wanted this thing to be was like a collection of great songs, and then at the end of it, you go, wow, who wrote all these songs? Oh, Merle Haggard wrote these? You know what I mean? So reappraise the guy and his work. You know?
Was when we were mixing the record, mixing the final tracks together and making them work together, Dave was laying on the, we were having a couple beers and the record was almost over. And Dave came off tour. He'd been on tour all year to finish the record, but Dave was laying on the floor and we were just enjoying the record, how it flowed together. And Dave said, it almost sounded like everybody had written these songs themselves, like Lucinda, it sounds like a Lucinda song, and Steve Young sounds like a Steve Young song, etc. They're so inside the material, which is mostly, you know, is what Dave was shooting for.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's certainly the match of singer to song is pretty incredible. I actually, at this point in time, my favorite match on the album is Billy Joe Shaver.
Oh, yeah.
And it's one of the better known of the Haggard songs, you know.
It's
close to a hit
too.
Song.
Yeah.
It is one of the hit songs. And I just think it's an incredible match. I mean,
yeah.
It's like, I can't think of a more definitive version.
Well, he flipped out. I mean, when we asked him, we wanted Billy Joe on the record, and we couldn't find him. And I was, make a long story short, where Andy and I were up doing a rodeo out in the middle of Alberta, and we came through the main gate, and somebody told us Billy Joe is on the bill, and he'd heard about it. And I went up and asked him, and he said, "Yeah, I gotta do that song. And he started saying the lyrics, but he didn't know the title, and I had to go home and listen to a few records. I realized he was talking about Ramblin' Fever, and then he finally did it down in. Nashville, that was a whole other funny thing.
I love it when he says, "Let some pretty lady rub my back."
Yeah.
He means it.
I think he is as close to that Haggard spirit as anybody. I mean, the rest of us are in other areas of music and been rock and but Billy Joe is kind of, when he did that record, Tramp on the Street, it was like, for a lot of people, this guy stepped out of a closet. Where has he been for 20 years? He's such a van out there with his road trailer and everything ready to go on the road, and I watched through the curtain, and he was jamming into the cassette machine, and he sat out there for about 20 minutes listening to the cut, the way I mixed it, and I thought, if he doesn't like this mix, he's coming right back through that door there with the van, you know. But after about 20 minutes, the van pulled away, so I thought, I guess he liked it okay. Last I ever heard of him. Still alive.
Tom Russell and Dave Alvin are with us on City Billy tonight. Andy Harden is patiently with guitar and laugh.
He's heard all these stories. I came to pick, man.
And they'll be at the Neighborhood Church on Saturday night. It starts at 8 o'clock. The Neighborhood Church is located at 301 North Orange Grove Boulevard in Pasadena. This is the launch of the fourth season of the Acoustic Music Series, and Dave and Tom and Andy will be joined by Peter Case on Saturday night. I had asked you discreetly while we were listening to Kern River whether there are other Haggard songs in the repertoire. Dave said if he had a beer, he would do if I make it till December, if we make it through December, but no beers in studio,
yeah,
so we don't get that. You got one that you would do, Tom, another Haggard song?
We could maybe do a Sing Me Back Home.
What key you do that in, Tom?
Key of G, Brother Dave.
Sounds like one of those old Carter Family recordings.
We used to do a ton of them back, and Andy and I played the honky-tonks for years, but unless you played it in the last 2 weeks, they kind of slipped back into, but try it. The warden led a prisoner down the hallway to his den, and I looked up, say goodbye like all the rest. And I heard him tell the warden just before he reached my cell, "Can my guitar playing friend do my request? Let him sing me back home, a song I used to hear. Make my old memories come alive. Oh, take me away and turn back the years. Sing me back home before I die." Dave.
Betty.
I recall last Sunday morning when a choir from off the street came by to sing a few old gospel songs. And I heard him tell the singer, there's a song my mama sang. Could you sing it once before you move along? Oh, please sing me back home a song I used to hear. Make my old memories come alive. Oh, take me away and turn back the year. Sing me back home before I die. Won't you sing me back home before I die?
If you're headed up north, all you have to do is you say you heard him on the show tonight.
If you
can find him,
Dave.
If you track down Dave, and he'll let you in free. Right now, you can get in free this Saturday night, but the catch is you got to be a KPCC member. We got 5 pairs of tickets, courtesy of Ron from the Acoustic Music Series. The phone number is 818-585-7893. The first 5 KPCC members get to see Dave Alvin, Tom Russell, Peter Case, Andy Harden, and any friends that show up on Saturday
night.
We're
going to drag Greg Lease down there and get Greg to make us sound
great.
Neighborhood Church is located at 301 North Orange Grove Boulevard in Pasadena. This is the kickoff for the 4th year of the Acoustic Music Series this Saturday night. Thanks, guys, for coming down.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Dave, let's do a longer one of these in the near future.
Anytime you want.
Let's find a reason to do that. We want to welcome John, who's here in studio. He's going to put you guys up, right?
John Polk, yes.
Okay. And we've got Mary here.
Yeah.
Mary,
yes.
Mary.
And Lloyd is here as well.
Bobby Lloyd Hicks from Springfield, Missouri. He just got here from the airport, too.
Yeah, Bobby Lloyd's going to play
from
on
the
our
skeletons.
Recordings.
Yeah,
okay.
The skeletons.
Good. So thank you. It's good to have you guys here.
Thank you.
Here's Tom's cut off To Larry Dust. It actually kicks off the album, They're Tearing the Labor Camps Down.